If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, you're listening to BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the editor of the magazine, and this is the first of our October 2011 editions. BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. You need to visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information, or keep track of us on Twitter, twitter.com/historyextra, and Facebook, facebook.com/historyextra. Coming up this issue.
And without hesitation, he dragged her by the hair.
Tracy Borman there on how William the Conqueror wooed his bride, Matilda.
Perfumes were quite important in the Bronze Age.
John Henderson on what archaeologists are learning from the submerged Bronze Age town of Pavlopetri. Okay, our first interview is with Tracy Borman, whose new book, Matilda, Queen of the Conqueror, has just been published. The Matilda in question was the queen of King William the Conqueror, who famously invaded England in 1066. Tracy has written a great feature for the October issue of the magazine, where she explores how Matilda had a key part to play in that Norman conquest. The first question I asked Tracy when I spoke to her was... Who is Matilda?
Well, it is a good question to start with because Matilda is so little known for such an important figure. She was Matilda of Flanders. She was born to Count Baldwin V of Flanders and Adela of France, who was the daughter of the King of France. So she was incredibly well connected, and she could trace her descent back to Charlemagne, the great emperor, as well as to King Alfred of England. And it was that connection in particular that would be really significant in Matilda's life. So she started off as, you know, very well-born young lady. As I say, she could she was connected to most of the royalty and dukes and princes within Europe. And yet, she sort of receded into the background of history, and it was only when she married the future William the Conqueror that she really came to prominence.
So
What was it that attracted her to William? How did William the Bastard, as he was known then, get embroiled with Matilda, this important figure from Europe's aristocracy?
Well, it's quite interesting because Matilda, it seems, was not at all attracted to William. She did not want anything to do with him. When he was proposed as a potential husband, nobody thought to actually consult Matilda because, of course, the negotiations, as usual, were conducted by the men in the family, and so it was her father, Baldwin, negotiating directly with William and his advisers. And they'd almost reached an agreement when suddenly, you know, somebody thought to consult Matilda. And she immediately said that she would not ally herself to the base-born Duke of Normandy, as she called him, you know, referring to his menial origins. As you mentioned, he was the illegitimate son of Duke Robert of Normandy. And so William, when he heard this, was absolutely furious because nobody so dared to insult William, this great warrior king who everybody feared. And as soon as he heard that Matilda had rejected him as a suitor, he rode at breakneck speed from Normandy across the border into Flanders, and he reached Matilda as she was apparently making her way to chapel in her father's palace in Bruges. And without hesitation, he dragged her by the hair and flung her down into the mud and kicked and beat her until she was almost dead. And then, the story goes, what did Matilda do? Well, you might expect this fiercely independent woman would just be outraged by such treatment. But apparently, she said, all right then, if you put it like that, I'll marry you.
So what year was this? When are we talking?
This was around 1049, 1050. As with so many events in the 11th century, particularly those involving women, we can't be absolutely certain about dates. But looking at the dates of their children when they were born, we can imagine it's around 1050.
Okay. And do we know how old William and Matilda were at this time?
Matilda would have been almost 20, sort of, you know, 19 or 20. William would have been in his mid-20s by then.
Mm. So would Matilda have been quite old to be married at that point?
Absolutely. It was quite common for daughters of noble families or royalty to be married off at 12. That was the sort of average age, really, at that time. And so Matilda may well have been wondering when it was her turn. I don't know if her father had waited for a suitably prestigious match. And indeed, Duke William was very prestigious at that time. But she was quite old, you know, especially if she was as old as 20. Most women would have already be on their kind of fifth child probably by then.
Yeah. So perhaps a surprising response being dragged around in the mud was that she thought she needed to get married and this was the best opportunity.
Exactly. I mean, that there are hints in the sources, and I do talk about this in my book, about there may have been a sort of darker side to Matilda's past which could have prompted her to change her mind about William, because there were rumours about Matilda and a certain Saxon nobleman who visited her father's court. He was named Britric, and there were rumours of an affair. We know for certain that Matilda actually proposed marriage to Britric, which was just not done. I mean, for a woman to actually, you know, not consult her father and just to go ahead and offer herself in marriage, but Britric spurned her, he turned her down. But there is the merest hint that there may have been a child as a result of their affair, and perhaps Matilda didn't want that scandal to come to light, so she decided that marriage to William was better than that.
Mm. Do we know what the respective positions of Normandy and Flanders were at the time? Was this an equal match, or was one side getting a better deal?
I think it was a pretty equal match because both provinces were on the up, really. Thanks to Baldwin, Flanders had become immensely influential in Europe.
Is basically the Low Countries.
Exactly,
isn't it, right?
Yes, and part most of which would be part of modern-day northern France, in fact, because it's sort of contracted since. But it was on the up. Towns were prospering as a result of trade. And Normandy, likewise, thanks to William, who, as I said, was this great warrior duke and who'd expanded the territories of Normandy substantially, was also a very good province with which to be allied. So it was a pretty much equal match. But Matilda never saw it that way. She seemed to see it as, you know, she was lowering herself to marry the illegitimate Duke of Normandy, who, as you said, was known as William the Bastard.
Mm. And do we, you know, once they'd got married,
McNamara, do we have a sense of whether they got on well? What sort of relationship did they have?
Well, the sources infer, you know, a picture of domestic harmony. Certainly it was one of the most dynastically successful marriages in history, because Matilda was almost constantly pregnant for the first 15 years of their marriage. She gave birth to at least 9 children. It could have been as many as 11. And the extraordinary thing is that not only she survived all of those births, but her children did. They all survived into adulthood, which was incredibly rare. It bucked all the trends of those times. And so in that sense alone, it was a very successful marriage. And also, you know, there are hints that they did get along quite well. They grew to be quite affectionate. But certainly it seems that William adored Matilda, and she perhaps tolerated him, and she enjoyed the power that the match gave her. But I don't think there was any real affection there on her part.
Because 9 kids from a standing start at the age of 20, perhaps was something before that. But that is, you know, even by today's standards, that would be pretty impressive.
It's very impressive. And also the fact that, you know, Matilda didn't look like she was built for childbirth. She was only 4'2", according to the remains that were discovered. Her skeleton was discovered at Caen in the 1960s and measured. And we can be pretty sure they were her bones that were found. And so, you know, really diminutive woman to give birth to 9, possibly 11 very healthy children is extraordinary.
And do we know what she looked like? You didn't say she's short. Do we have any contemporary portraits or anything like that to give us an idea about what sort of woman she was?
There are no surviving contemporary images, but what we do have are engravings that have passed through the centuries of earlier portraits. So in a way, it might be like sort of Chinese whispers in paintings, in that remarkably, most of them are done in the 19th century, and Matilda looks a lot like Queen Victoria, which you think is perhaps a little bit suspicious. But the written accounts of Matilda all attest to her beauty. She was lauded for her beauty, and she was seen, you know, as one of the most attractive consorts in Europe. But then it was fairly typical for chroniclers to flatter the wives of important men. But also Matilda's daughters were seen as great beauties, so I think there may have been something behind those descriptions.
Okay. So they got married in the mid-11th century. For the next decade or so, William would have been charging around northern France, securing his possessions, fighting various wars. Would Matilda have been with him, or would she have stayed in Caen or somewhere like that? What did we know what was going on there?
Yeah, we can trace Matilda's movements as well as William's, and she was constantly on the move. She was always travelling, even though, you know, often heavily pregnant at the time, she was always on the move, because she realised, I think even more than William did, the need to be visible to their subjects. And so William did begin to give her a lot of power, because he was off on campaign so much that he needed somebody to focus on the sort of political affairs of his dukedom, and Matilda was perfect for that. She'd been raised as the daughter of one of the most important political figures in Europe, and she was incredibly canny in that respect. And so she earned herself a lot of respect, a lot of power during those kind of critical years when Normandy was really taking hold.
Okay. And then sort of moving forward in time a bit, we get to the sort of the big event in William's reign, or at least as we remember it now, 1066, the invasion of England, the Battle of Hastings, and all that followed. What was Matilda doing?
Matilda was fully behind the invasion for a start, because, you know, it's easy for us to see with hindsight that it was inevitable. Of course, the Norman conquest, we all know the outcome of that. But in fact, it was seen as an extraordinarily risky enterprise at the time. And William was not expected to succeed, because his claim to the English throne was quite dodgy, frankly. And, you know, a lot of it possibly was a result of Norman propaganda after the event, claiming that Edward the Confessor had named William his heir. And we're not sure if he did or when he did. But Matilda, from the beginning of William sort of conceiving this idea of invading England, was fully behind him. And she built a famous flagship, the Mora, in which William sailed over to England. And she made all sorts of religious bequests in order to kind of give the sort of God's sanction, really, to the invasion. So she was enormously influential. But I think her most important contribution to the Norman conquest was that she took over the reins of government in Normandy. She was appointed officially as regent of Normandy, which really gave William the freedom to then pursue his ambitions in England.
Ah, so she didn't go to England with a fleet, she stayed in Normandy.
She stayed in Normandy initially. It was in fact 2 years after the Battle of Hastings that she joined William. And the reason for the delay is well, firstly, she had lots of business to conduct in Normandy, because of course the dukes, all the powerful dukes and earls and subjects in Normandy were very quick to try and seize the opportunity of William's absence to seize power themselves. But Matilda stopped them from doing that. She was a very effective ruler. But also, she was probably pregnant yet again during that time. And indeed, when she finally arrived in England, she was pregnant with her ninth or final child, certainly. And it was enormously significant that she gave birth to that child on English soil, and he would become indeed the future King of England.
And who was that, sorry?
That was Henry, her youngest son. Right. And actually the only son. She had four sons, but he was the only son whom the English actually recognised as being legitimate, and largely because he was born on English soil.
So how difficult was it for Matilda in Normandy to exercise the power that William had entrusted in her? You talked about the great men trying to take advantage.
Yeah.
What could she do to stop that?
I think Matilda, I mentioned earlier, she's constantly travelling, and I think that was really the key to her success, because she made sure that the Norman family were very visible in the province of Normandy. So she made use of her sons, her other sons, to sort of be symbols of her and William's power. She was just very politically astute, so she would hold court, she would be able to witness charters. Her signature is present on hundreds of charters from this time. So she was right at the heart of business. She had a real attention to detail and made sure that all the business was conducted through her. So it's quite interesting. I mean, she's often seen if she's seen at all, then it's as a passive wife whose only preoccupation at this time was making the Bayeux tapestry. You know, she was, but in fact, she probably didn't do that at all. I wouldn't imagine she'd had time. Her business was primarily one of government.
Okay. Once William had gone across the Channel, won his famous victory, had himself crowned, then Matilda eventually comes over. What does she then do? How does she help William secure his throne in England?
Matilda was enormously influential in England. She came over in 1068, around Easter time, and the first thing she did was to set about planning a magnificent coronation. Again, she had a real talent for PR. She liked public sort of shows of royalty, and she instituted things called crown wearings, where people just flocked to pay homage to herself and William. And her coronation was the largest ever seen for a queen. She was almost crowned as being an equal to her husband, which was enormously significant. She was the first of the queens of England to be formally recognised as queen, because before that the Saxons had merely referred to a queen as the king's wife. But Matilda was, William and Matilda both made a lot of her dynastic legitimacy. It was really essential to William that his own bastardy be kind of disguised by the fact his wife could trace her descent to King Alfred. So the coronation was an important beginning. But then, as she did in Normandy, she involved herself very closely in all of the affairs of England, from justice to legal affairs to religious matters. She wanted all the business to come through her. And so William did increasingly rely on her in affairs of the English government, as he did in Normandy.
So what did the English people think about that? Because if what you're saying is right, and I'm sure it is, about the Anglo-Saxons and the Saxons not having this view of a queen, then they must have been slightly perturbed by her having so much power.
Absolutely, and for the first few years of Matilda's reign, they called her the strange woman. You know, it wasn't an overnight success for Matilda. She had to work really hard to overcome their prejudices. And I think she just was very talented at sort of courting the affections of her people. And just gradually and quite subtly, she began to win popularity. And it was through by being kind of quite understanding of their needs, because William just... You know, he implemented his rule by fire, by rampage, by just quashing the spirit, really, of the English. Whereas Matilda tried to respect their traditions. For example, the death of Edward the Confessor's widow, Queen Edith, who was seen as really the true queen. Matilda insisted that Edith be given a very lavish funeral and be paid every possible respect. And it was gestures like that that really won over the English people. And they did begin to respect her as queen and not just as the king's wife.
Edward the Confessor, of course, was the king who didn't immediately precede William because there was Harold between them.
Exactly.
But he was the last Anglo-Saxon king.
Absolutely.
So when did Edith die then? Was she was still
that
alive
was,
well
that
into
was
the
1075. Race. So really, until her death, she was seen as the true queen, and Matilda had to battle against that because she was, of course, the symbol of the Saxon dynasty versus these hated Norman oppressors.
Yeah. Did they meet, Edith and
There's
and
no record that they actually met. No, not at all. But Matilda was very aware of her. And I think as soon as Edith had died, then that really paved the way to Matilda's full acceptance by the English people.
But presumably she was never in a position as modern parlance would say, a people's princess. She would never have had the affection of the English people because she'd come across as a conqueror and a foreigner.
I think she did become very popular. I mean, obviously, she was a Norman and she was the symbol of the Norman dynasty. But, you know, there are many reports later on in Matilda's reign of, you know, thousands of people flocking to see her. And she was known as Queen Matilda, wealthy and powerful. And people would actively seek her patronage. It was more of a sort of respectful relationship she had with the English, perhaps, than the sort of, you know, wildly popular, you know, affectionate feelings that they had towards Queen Edith, who died in 1075.
You say that she was important in how the Normans sorted out their power base and made themselves the kings of England. So how significant was she in that? Would William have not been able to establish himself as well as he had if he hadn't been married to Matilda?
I think without a doubt, William would not have been able to conquer England, or at least hold on to England in the way that he did, had it not been for his wife sort of working behind the scenes, really, in sort of courting popularity for the Norman dynasty. Because, you know, it's all very well for William to be winning victories by the sword, but unless he won the affection of the people and the loyalty of the people, then those victories meant nothing. And that's what Matilda was working towards, really winning over the English people's loyalty. And the fact that she just had that kind of knack for public relations. She knew, for example, I mentioned that her last child, Henry, was born on English soil. Well, not just on English soil, on Yorkshire soil, because Yorkshire was one of the most rebellious provinces in England. And so there's Matilda, she's about 8.5 months pregnant, and she decides that she's going to join William up north in York to give birth there, because William was currently besieging the city of York, and she wanted the prince, as she was confident it would be, to be born on Yorkshire soil. And she made it as far as Selby, which is about 14 miles south of York, but it was enough of a symbol.
Do we have any inkling of how far or whether William at all recognised or appreciated what Matilda was doing?
I think the symbol of that is just how much affection and respect William felt for Matilda, because there are numerous references, and increasingly so, of William, you know, saying how much he adored Matilda, how she was his equal in government. You know, he really did, and this was not a man who gave out praise easily. And so she had really gained his respect, she'd gained his admiration, and I think that was enormously significant. And just the very fact, you know, as well as his words, his actions spoke for him, because he was always deputising, you know, he was always giving business to Matilda to conduct on his behalf, both in England and in Normandy. So he recognised how important she was. And that in itself was really significant. Kings didn't often do this. The Queen was there largely in a sort of domestic capacity to produce the heirs, to look after the household, not to get involved in government.
Okay. Who died first? Who outlived?
Matilda died first in 1083 in Caen. And unfortunately, though, by that stage, their relationship had really broken down, because some years previously, in around 1077, her eldest son Robert, nicknamed Robert Curt Hose on account of his short stature, rebelled against William. And rather than standing by her husband, as everybody would expect, Matilda secretly funded Robert's rebellion. She sent him money while he was in exile. And William, of course, found out in the spy-ridden world of the Norman court, and he berated Matilda in front of the entire court. She was lucky to escape with her life, actually, because she was effectively a traitor in supporting her eldest son. But William forgave her, but things were never the same between them. And actually, he did deprive her of power from that day forward. And I think that's when you suddenly start getting talk in the sources of Matilda's failing health. It was like this incredibly energetic, resilient woman really fed from the power that she was given. And when that was taken away, she began to decline.
Okay. How unusual was she as a woman at this period?
I think Matilda was quite extraordinary for that time. The mid-11th century wasn't a great epoch of sort of powerful women. That's not to say she was the only powerful woman in history, of course. There had been other examples. The 10th century was quite a sort of zenith for female power, but then that did decline, and we find that there's sort of a regression to just sort of male domination. But there was one other example I would like to just highlight, and that was Queen Emma, who was another early 11th century queen in England, and she did try to gain an enormous amount of power for herself, but it's quite interesting because she failed largely. She dominated her sons, who then sort of took the throne, but she never quite succeeded. She was never fully recognised as queen in her own right, even though she was a great self-publicist and tried very hard. And I think Emma did meet Matilda when Matilda was very young. She came over to Flanders to seek refuge there, and I think she probably did influence Matilda as a sort of example of a great female sort of role model. But really, Matilda carved out a new position. There had been no other sort of directly comparable queen consort before Matilda, who'd really taken on almost an equal status with the king. That was extraordinary.
So was she a trailblazer for future queens?
She was absolutely a trailblazer, and she carved out a new role model, really, a new model of queenship that other queens would then seek to emulate, notably her own daughter-in-law, Matilda of Scotland. You get lots of Matildas around this time, funnily enough. And then, of course, we have Empress Matilda in the following century. And even the likes of the great, you know, Eleanor of Aquitaine, you can hark back to the model that Matilda had set up and which queens consort who followed her all tried to copy.
So, if she was so important, why isn't she more prominent in the historical record thus far? Why don't people talk about her?
I think it shows a great deal of bias on the part of the contemporary chroniclers, in that they all tend to focus on the role of William, and this was typical. It wasn't just Matilda, but other women of the 11th century are sort of not given the prominence they deserve. So it's only by tracing her actions and really piecing together the threads of her life that you realise just how influential she was. And also, she's just overshadowed by the great sort of warrior king that William was. It's the date that every schoolchild knows, 1066. 66 has gone down, you know, as the most famous date in history. And I think that itself has overshadowed. It's seen 1066 is just inextricably linked with William the Conqueror, and his wife is just, and most people who I talk to about my book say, I didn't even know William was married. You know, Matilda is so little known, but really, really undeservedly so.
Did you find enough records to go on then to piece together this story? And if so, where were they? What sort of records were you looking at?
I was very pleasantly surprised, because I did begin this project not knowing if I would be able to construct a book out of it, because, you know, sources in the 11th century are pretty scarce, certainly compared to my last book on Elizabeth I. But I was just really amazed by the richness of the sources. They're largely Norman sources, so there is a little bit of bias in some of them. And they're written by the monastic chroniclers of the 11th and 12th centuries primarily. And so Norman French is something that I had to become familiar with, although there are some English translations. So most of the contemporary records were from Normandy, but also then to counter that, we have records such as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. Of course, Domesday Book was an enormously valuable source because it helped chart Matilda's wealth, her landholdings and her influence in judicial cases. And then we have sort of pictorial evidence of the Bayeux Tapestry, and then the architectural evidence from both England and Normandy. So all pieced together, incredibly rich as a historical source.
She doesn't feature in the Bayeux Tapestry, does she?
She doesn't. There is a theory that one of her daughters is represented, because her probably Adeliza, her eldest daughter, was betrothed to Harold as part of a pact. When Harold was captured in Normandy just shortly before he became king, he promised to recognise William's claim to the throne. Well, this is according to Norman version of events. And William and Matilda's eldest daughter was given as a bargain in that. And that may be depicted in the Bayeux Tapestry, but there are various other theories about what this mysterious woman who appears in the tapestry, you know, who she actually was.
And lastly, you talked about the architectural sources. If I had a mind to go somewhere to try and understand Matilda, is there anywhere you particularly recommend that I should head off and have a look at?
I think if you were to go as far afield as Normandy, then you should head straight to Caen, where the two abbeys that William and Matilda built are still in existence, and indeed they're buried in each of their abbeys. So Matilda's tomb you can still visit. That would be a great place to start. And other palaces, you know, still in existence, or at Rouen, for example, which was another seat of power. And Falaise, which has gone down in legend as being, you know, the place of William's birth, and his father was said to have, you know, been strolling around the ramparts one evening when he'd spotted William's future mother washing clothes in a stream and fell in love with her, although really he'd have needed a good pair of binoculars because it's quite a way from the castle. But back in England, you'd have to start at the Tower of London, which, you know, is possibly the most iconic Norman site that we have, and William built it to suppress the evil inhabitants of London, as he called them. And interesting also to head over to Gloucester, where Matilda's rebellious firstborn son is buried in the cathedral.
Brilliant. I'm delighted to be able to report to you that I have been to all those sites you've mentioned.
Fantastic.
Barring Falaise. I went there, but the castle was shut.
Oh, so
there's another podcast there, places I've been to that have been shut. Tracy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
That was Tracy Borman. You can read her feature in the October issue of the magazine, and her book, Matilda, Queen of the Conqueror, is published now by Jonathan Cape. Next, I've been talking to John Henderson of Nottingham University, where he is an Associate Professor of Archaeology. John's specialism is underwater archaeology, and one of his most exciting projects is the investigation of a submerged city off the coast of Greece, and that city is called Pavlo Petri. The research he's doing there is the subject of a forthcoming BBC Two documentary. So when I spoke to John, the first question I put to him was, Pavlo Petri, where is it and what is it?
Well, Pavlo Petri, it's the oldest submerged town in the world. It's just off the southern coast of Greece, off the peninsula of Laconia, near Neapoli. And it's literally just a few metres off the coast of southern Greece. And it covers an area of about 8 hectares. It's about 8 football pitches, something like that. And it's the remains of an entire Bronze Age city. And as you sort of swim over it, you sort of see a massive spread of stones, and then you begin to notice in amongst that walls, and then once you see a wall, you realise it's part of a building foundation, and then you see that building out into courtyards. There's quite some paved streets. There's larger public buildings. There's things we think might be shrines. In amongst that, there's graves. There's rock slab cut graves. There's massive rock cut chambered tombs. I mean, as an archaeologist, underwater sites don't get much better than that.
Okay. You say it's Bronze Age. Can you just put that in context a bit? What dates are we talking about, and what else was going on in and around Greece at the time?
Well, I think this is one of the really exciting things about this site is just the date. It's the Bronze Age is basically from about 3000 to 1000 BC. And we actually found last year at Pavlopetri pottery from the final Neolithic, the final Stone Age, so from about 3500 BC. So we've got a settlement that seems to be beginning as a Neolithic village, probably involved in fishing and that kind of thing, and then growing and becoming a city by the end of the Bronze Age. And I think it's a really important period in terms of the development of human society. And in some ways, we can trace the beginnings of European city and town life in Pavlopetri. If you think at the beginning of it, you know, the end of the Stone Age, we've got people still living farming lifestyles, basically concerned with subsistence and that kind of thing, and then beginning to produce a surplus. And once they do that, that frees them and allows them to concentrate in other things. Once you can produce a surplus, people can specialise in other areas of work, and you start getting a sort of level of complexity in society, and you get professions, you get people beginning to become full-time craftsmen, potters, bronze workers, artists, that kind of thing. But the other thing, of course, about the Bronze Age is people start using bronze. And bronze, you know, to make bronze, you need copper and tin. Copper and tin are never found together. And particularly, there's not, you know, major deposits of copper or tin in Greece. And so to enter into the Bronze Age world, really they had to trade, and they had to get that copper and tin to make bronze. And that's kind of the key to the Bronze Age and the developments we see. People have to be in contact with each other. Exchange has to take place. And that, again, leads to a complexity. People are ideas, goods, even people are moving around the Eastern Mediterranean. And I think the key thing about Pavlopetri is, of course, it's a port town, and it's right at the cusp of that. And the new influences coming from areas further to the east, you know, Egypt and Syria and places like that, are beginning to have a massive effect on the society, and they're becoming modern in a way that we would recognise today. So we've got the whole story, really, from Stone Age farmers right up to a quite complex administration city-like life with, you know, ships going up and down the Mediterranean. And that's what's really exciting for me about it.
Okay, so it ties in with the wider network. Do we have any evidence for what was going on here other than what you've been finding? I mean, is there any documentary evidence that tells us anything at all about Pavlopetri?
Well, this is the period of the Greek Bronze Age. I mean, it's a good 2,000 years, 3,000 to 1,000 BC. It's basically as distant as we are from the Romans now. So it's a very long period of time. And within that period, we have the growth of the Minoan civilization, the first European civilization, really, which appears on Crete. And then slightly later, from about 1,600 BC, we have the Mycenaean civilization growing up in the mainland of Greece. And in terms of documentary evidence, we don't actually have writing of history at that period, but we do have the beginnings of writing, and that's more related to administration, related to recording the goods that are being moved back and forth. So the Minoans and the Mycenaeans, about, you know, over 100 years ago, these civilizations were unknown. But now, as more and more work's being done on them, they're turning out to be much more advanced than anyone had really previously thought. In fact, a lot of the things that you would associate with the Romans, such as, you know, roads, aqueducts, writing, bridges, were all in existence in the Bronze Age. They were all done, you know, a good few thousand years before the Romans appeared. And there's people know about the palatial centres on Crete. You've got sites such as Knossos. You've also got Mycenae, obviously, mentioned by Homer. But it's a palatial, it's a large citadel in mainland Greece. And we know a bit about the major centres, about the, you know, the citadels that grew up. But we don't know so much about the trade that allowed these centres to develop. And that's what's exciting about Pavlopeti. It's a harbour town. It becomes a harbour city. This was where the trade and interactions that allowed these cities to develop actually took place.
So Pavlopeti doesn't feature in any of those sources that you mentioned.
We don't know what Pavlopeti was actually called. It's called Pavlopeti just because there's a small island near the site which is called Pavlopeti, Peter and Paul in Greek.
Right.
And there's no written reference to it. However, there might be a name that we haven't recognised yet in the text, which actually does relate to Pavlopeti. So it's a bit mysterious in some ways.
So when did it first, you know, come to light then? It's been lost for millennia, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, it was discovered in 1967 by an oceanographer called Nick Fleming, who's based at the University of Southampton. And he was in the area actually looking for submerged towns. And he came across Pavlopeti. You know, it was just a major discovery at the time. And then in 1968, a team from the University of Cambridge went back and actually planned the remains they could see at the time, just with hand tapes and measuring tapes and snorkels, and it produced a fantastic plan of a Bronze Age town. And it actually, in terms of archaeology, it was a major discovery, and anyone who was doing underwater archaeology knew about it. But then there was no further work after that. It basically went into the care of the Greek state, and there's been no excavation on the site and no further survey.
Okay, but now you've come along and you've been able to get the necessary permits to start doing some work on it.
Yes, I mean, we're working in collaboration with the Greek government, with the Hellenic Ministry of Culture, underwater archaeology effort, they're called, the underwater archaeology team. So it's a collaboration between Greece and the British School in Athens. And it's the first time, I think, a foreign school has worked in collaboration with the Greeks to do some actual excavation underwater. We started the excavations this year.
And why are you, an academic from Nottingham, involved in this? How do you come to be part of this?
Well, for me, it's a bit of a dream because I first read about Pavlopeti when I was a 13-year-old boy. I had a book, The Atlas of Underwater Archaeology, and there was actually a paper in it written by Nick Fleming, and it had a picture of Pavlopeti and the plan of it. And I thought one day I would just like to swim on that. I'd like to at least dive on it. And then the opportunity came to actually work on the site because we had a postdoctoral fellow called Chrysanthi Gallo at the University of Nottingham who was studying the pottery from the original 68 season, the pottery that was lifted up then. And we just got talking and thought, well, wouldn't it be great to go back and actually, you know, survey it using modern methods, using all the new technologies that are available now and in as much 3D detail as we can. And I've been involved in underwater survey for a number of years, although most of it's been, you know, work in Western Europe, although I've worked around the world. The good thing about underwater archaeology is you get to travel quite a bit. So it was really just an opportunity and we just went for it. And I'm absolutely thrilled that I did. I mean, it's just an amazing site to work on.
And does the current financial situation in Greece affect research at all? Does it impact on what you can and can't do?
Of course it has an impact. Money's harder to find in terms of grants. And the grants aren't as high as they used to be because, you know, there's not as much money in them anymore. But because we're working off getting academic grants, we also have private sponsors involved in the project, it doesn't affect us too much in terms of raising the money. Well, things are more expensive than they were. But the other thing that we're hoping to do with Pavlopeti in the future is develop some sort of centre for public awareness there, maybe create a museum near it to help not only protect the site, but also help develop the area, because that part of Laconia is absolutely beautiful in southern Greece, and yet it's not really developed, it's not really on the tourist map yet. And one of the great assets that Greece has, of course, is its heritage. Yeah. And that kind of longer-term view, I would like to leave a legacy behind from this project where not only people can go and visit the site and see the things we've found, but equally there's some level of protection for it as well, because, of course, it's so close to the coast. It's just off a beautiful sandy beach. People can go and, you know, take bits of it off, you know, take bits of pottery off. At least that was happening before we started. Now that we've got the project in place, the local community know about it, the Coast Guard are guarding it, it's illegal to do that. But you really need a presence there. I mean, the protection of underwater sites is a difficult one because you need a kind of a pair of eyes keeping an eye on it, if you know what I mean. And that's what we're hoping to get from this project.
Right. Give me a taste of what was going on in Pavlopeti in, I don't know, in 1500 BC or something like that. What sort of activities have you been able to identify?
Well, the site itself is just strewn with ceramics and finds. I mean, there's literally thousands of ceramics all over it. And what we can see from that is that there's trade, say about 1600 BC, we've got a lot of evidence for trade with Crete. So we know that people were, boats were going in, they were coming, you know, coming back laden with large storage vessels, pithos storage vessels, which would have been filled with things like, you know, olive oil, grain, probably perfumes. Perfumes were quite important in the Bronze Age. Smelling nice seemed to be a thing that people were quite into. And we can tell from that, you know, that we've got scribes, we've got people recording what's coming in and out, we've got merchants and traders. There's obviously some sort of organisation, there'll be some sort of level of city leaders and so on. And amongst the plan that we have, you know, buildings sitting side by side in streets, almost like a kind of prehistoric suburbia. You've got, you know, for a lot, amongst the first time really in Europe, this is one of the sites where people are beginning to live a kind of town life with neighbours, you know, meeting them in the street, perhaps even, you know, commuting to work and things like that. So it's a very complex picture. As I said, there's about 2,000 years at least worth of occupation there, and we're only just beginning to scrape that surface.
That's quite an astonishing concept that prehistoric people were commuting to work. Is that, you know, are you stretching the truth there? Or is that,
I'm stretching it a bit there, I think. I was just trying to think of a way of seeing a connection with a sort of modern suburban life. Because
but you do see it as a suburbia, a Bronze Age suburbia?
In some ways, yeah, because we've got the domestic dwellings, you know, in streets, in little clusters, side by side. And we've got larger sort of what look to be sort of public type buildings. And we're beginning to see, you know, just, I keep coming back to this, but this idea, a level of complexity which hasn't been seen before. And I think this is when humans are beginning to kind of realise their potential in some ways. The connections that have broken, that have opened up as a result of the trade in bronze have suddenly, you know, created somewhat of a revolution, you know, the birth of European life. I think the Minoan culture in Crete has been referred to as the naissance of European life, you know, so we have the Renaissance afterwards, but the naissance was perhaps in the Bronze Age.
So what do you have any idea about why it might have become submerged?
Okay, I mean, there's two main reasons why a site's underwater. Either the sea level comes up, or the land itself goes down. And we know in the Mediterranean that the sea levels were more or less the same as they are today, within about a meter, around 3000 BC. So what we're actually looking at is we're looking at earthquake activity. We're looking at earth movements. And the Aegean, the Eastern Mediterranean, is one of the most active tectonic earthquake zones in the world. And you have all across that area sites that have been submerged. You know, we know that Pavlo Petri's gone down by about 4 to 5 meters. Areas such as the Bay of Naples in Italy has gone down by 10 meters, and there's Roman remains there. But equally, in other areas, that pushes land up. So you have, you know, in Western Crete's gone up by about 6 meters. So essentially, it's earthquake activity. And one of the things we want to try and work out is did it go down in one event, or did it go down in a series of events after about 1000 BC?
Finally, let me ask you, what are your hopes for the project? What sort of questions are you hoping you might be able to get an answer to at the end of your research here?
Well, quite simply, I really just want to know what was going on at Pavlo Petri, who was living there, what they were doing, but be able to date some of the buildings. I mean, the thing is, at the moment, we have a plan which seems to be a sort of coherent whole, but we know we have pottery across 2,000 years, at least. And we did some test pits this year, two small test excavations, and we came down mainly on 17th century BC occupation. So I don't know where the later occupation is from there. And what I want to do is be able to actually date the buildings, you know, relate the pottery that we're seeing on the seabed to the buildings itself, and maybe begin to start to tell this story of a Neolithic fishing village, a Stone Age fishing village, developing into quite an important harbour town, and then into, you know, a major port. And then what happened, you know, after 1100 BC, we have no further evidence for occupation. Where did the people go? You know, why did they leave? Was it a natural, natural catastrophe? Was it an earthquake? Was it just something that was happening more widely in the Bronze Age? Because it's quite common at this period that sites become abandoned.
Lastly, is this the most exciting underwater dig you've worked on? Or you said you've worked all over the world. Have you actually been anywhere better than this?
No, I think this is the most exciting site I've ever worked on. I mean, sites like this don't come along every day, and it's just a real honour and a privilege to be able to work on it. And certainly some of my colleagues have said to me, you know, how did you get to work in that site? And it's really, we asked. We decided, could we do it? And it's just, you know, I'm just every day I'm diving on that site when we're working there. It's just, I just can't believe it. And just the idea that, you know, because the sea is constantly moving things around, it's constantly excavating the site in some ways, you always find something new. Every dive you're finding something. And that's, you know, that's pretty rare.
That was John Henderson of Nottingham University. And City Beneath the Waves, Pavlo Petri, is showing on the 9th of October at 8 p.m. on BBC Two. Do get in touch if you've got any comments on the podcast. The email is podcast@historyextra.com, or as I said at the start, you can get us on Twitter, twitter.com/historyextra, and Facebook, facebook.com/historyextra. Next week, we'll be talking about English history with Peter Ackroyd, and we will be seeing who's new in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us next week.